session number 10409, Rule 4.
Mr. Gordon Hyams, Rule 4. You mentioned the Gotha bombing raids. How close to you did they come, and did they affect you?
No, they didn't affect us, really, because our seaplanes couldn't come within a close distance of them. But Manston used to go up on fighters.
What was the target they were looking for?
The Gothas? I really don't know. It might have been London, but any place. That was the place where they entered English airspace.
They didn't bomb any of the stations then.
Not there. They didn't bomb us or Manston at the time, anyhow.
Now, on the 22nd of the 8th, 1917, 22nd of August.
Yes.
I note from your logbook that you had a bit of a crash on takeoff. What do you remember about that?
Oh, that was a time when I was one of my early flights on a SOP with Snyder, and there was very little wind and apparently no rough sea, so I decided to take a downwind takeoff, but unfortunately before I got airborne I ran into a bit of a swell which caught my floats, and the next thing I knew I was cartwheeling and then landed upside down in the machine. I gave a heave and got out. That was the first real crash that I'd had. But at any rate,
Was there any sort of inquiry into it?
Well, not an inquiry. I was interviewed by my station commander and told him what I'd done and that I'd taken off downwind, which was not the correct thing to do. And I then mentioned that that was the last time I'd try taking off downwind. And he said, oh no, not at all. There may be conditions where you've got to. At any rate, I didn't get much of a ticking off.
Now, round about the 17th of September, you were posted to Killingholme. What sort of a setup did they have there? You were only there briefly before going...
Yes, well, Killingholme was a very large base on the Humber near Hull, and they flew large H-12 flying boats, well, on submarine hunts, but they went well out to sea towards the Dutch coast. The base was used as a training station for these boat pilots.
You didn't fly the H-12, though, yourself?
I never flew it, but another thing which I did fly there was the a small FBA flying boat again, and within a few days I was posted to a substation at Hornsey Mere, where I was supposed to fly FBAs. At any rate, I did go over there in an FBA, which was quite a nice trip, and I quite enjoyed it. And I was accompanied by Flight Lieutenant P. P.D. Robertson, who was taking over command of Hornsey from Flight Lieutenant Mallet. And we both flew over together, and that was that. Very shortly afterwards, I'd forgotten how many days, I had my first flight in a Sopwith baby seaplane with a Clerget engine, which was the main machine which was based at Hornsey. Hornsey was a small station with about half a dozen pilots, and our job.
How many planes did you have?
How many?
How many aircraft would there be? Seaplanes would there be?
Oh, I should think there would be probably half a dozen Sopwith babies there.
And how many tradesmen, fitters and such like?
How many?
Fitters, the tradesmen, how many of them would there be?
Oh, I really can't remember. There was just sufficient number to maintain the machines. That was riggers and engine fitters, and unskilled airmen who did all the usual station work.
What sort of a relationship did you have with your fitters?
Oh, very good indeed. We were all, the station was so small, but we were all very much on friendly terms. The other curious man we had was a petty officer, pigeons, birds, which we used to take with us in boxes whenever we went on patrol. And these were very useful because if anything happened and we had to alight, we could write a message and put it in a little aluminium container on the bird's leg and release it from the water. And they invariably came home almost immediately.
What billets were you given? What was your accommodation at Hornsey?
We were all billeted out on various people. And I was very fortunate in billeting out by in the house of an elderly lady, Miss Warburton, whose very ancient father was also living with her. And he was very senile and practically never spoke a word, but used to sit in his chair smoking his pipe. I was very fortunate because they were very nice people and looked after me well.
Did they provide all your meals? Or did
they
you
provided
mess?
All our meals.
So did you have a formal mess where you...
Oh, no, we didn't have a mess, you see, there. Until right at the end of my stay there, when a big house just close to Hornsey Mere was taken over, and then we did start a mess. But I was only there a very, very short time before I was posted away.
Did you socialise much with the other pilots then, in the evening?
Not very much, because we were all scattered about. But I did get to know two or three families living at Hornsey who were very, very hospitable, and I used to go and visit them quite often.
So the local civilians were very friendly to you?
Oh, very friendly, yes.
What was your daily routine like at Hornsey? How would you start the day?
Well, it was very happy-go-lucky in a way, but it was very efficient. One pilot was told off for the early morning patrol, and that was round about 6 o'clock. And one of the airmen, who was probably billeted near us, used to come and wake us up. The way I used to do it was with a ball of string with a lump of small lump of metal at the side, and when I went to bed, I used to throw this weighted end out of the window and attach the rest of it to myself in bed. And when he came along, he used to give a tug at this, and that meant that it was time for me to get up.
This was to avoid waking the people you were billeting.
Oh, yes, yes.
What time would this be, roughly speaking?
Oh, it would have been probably around about 6 o'clock, I suppose.
Was it at dawn, basically?
It was at dawn, yes. And then we used to go down to the station and do our patrol. Now,
What kit would you take with you to go in the aeroplane? You'd have your pigeon.
Yes.
What else would you take with you when you went?
The only other thing you would took was a little box of Horlick's malted milk tablets, which were very useful for keeping you more or less sustained during the flight. I think, first of all, I ought to describe Hornsey Mere a bit, which was quite a large lake with an island in the middle. And the great advantage of being stationed there was that you could take off in practically any weather when it was quite impossible for the Killingholme people to venture out. The only time when we couldn't fly, or times, was if there was an extraordinarily high wind and they couldn't open the canvas hangar where the machines were kept. And on a short period during the winter, when the Mere froze over, and of course we couldn't do anything then, but otherwise it was an ideal place to have a seaplane station.
The hangars were just canvas, were they?
It was what they call a Bessano hangar. I think it's... Will you cut off? There were buildings on the little bit of land, which was really a little peninsula where the station was, and those, and there was also a small shed, which was in civilian times a little sort of cafe, and that was kept going during the war, and the owner, Mr. Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, used to provide chocolate or biscuits and that sort of thing, or a cup of tea. But otherwise, there were buildings which were used... I really don't know what their use was in peacetime, but we had part of this. Downstairs was a part of the maintenance system, especially the engines. They couldn't get the aircraft, and the rigging was done either in the hangar or in fine weather in the open. And the pilots had a small room next door to the sort of waiting room in the upper part of the building, where there was a bed and a telephone, and one of us used to be on duty each night and slept there in case anything happened. But he didn't do the early morning patrol.
What would he... When you went off for your early morning patrol, how many people would there be controlling what was going on at the station?
Just a handful of... probably a rigger and a fitter, and one or two men to handle the machine.
How did you know which way to go? Who told you that?
Where to fly to?
Yes.
Well, we had an all-over cover from Hornsey Mere, which was just a few miles north of the Humber estuary, and just south of Bridlington, and our normal beat was up the coast, past Scarborough, and then Filey, and right up to the mouth of the Tees, where there was another similar station, which did the next part of the patrol. And our normal route was quite close to the coast, which was where the shipping went up and down, and we were supposed to protect them from submarines. But we did have also searches further out to sea, just to see if there was anything there. It was really, in a way, quite a boring thing, but it was quite enjoyable. Our normal length of in the air was somewhere about an hour and a half. It depended a good deal on what activity on the water there was, and also on the weather. I did manage to, on one occasion, to extend that to well over 2 hours, which caused a bit of a flurry at the station because they thought that I'd come down somewhere through lack of petrol. But actually, it was due to the fact that I had a good engine, which I managed to throttle down, which was not easy on a rotary engine, to about 900 revolutions per minute instead of the normal 1,000.
When you were out for normally about an hour and a half.
Yes.
In winter especially, wasn't it very cold? What did you wear to keep the cold out?
Well, we wore a leather jacket and a flying helmet, which was generally covered a bit of your face and ears. But I had rather a nice one which came right over your head and under your chin, and you could tuck it into your coat. And that was very useful, and it wasn't really too cold.
Did you have? You presumably didn't have a parachute.
Oh no, there were no parachutes in those days. The only thing you had was an inflatable life belt, rubber life belt, which you had round your neck and secured around your waist, which you could, if you did come down and were in trouble, you could inflate by pressing a lever on a little compressed air bottle which was attached to the life belt.
How high would you fly?
That depended a good deal on the weather. Normally, well under 1,000 feet, because that was where you could see what was happening very much better. But at times we did go up higher. it really depended on what the conditions in the air was, because further up towards the Tees, it was often very foggy due to the ironworks. Let's see what else was there to do.
What were you looking for? I mean,
we were looking for submarines.
What traces would you regard? What sort of? I mean, how would they betray themselves?
They'd betray themselves because they were travelling with the conning tower exposed, and you could see, if you couldn't see the conning tower because it was below water, they had their periscope up, and you could spot that and the wake that it caused.
Could you see them underwater?
No, you couldn't see them underwater at all. That was quite a erroneous idea that you could see underwater.
Would they leave any traces if they, for instance, gone down just before you got there? Was there anything you were told to look out for?
Well, you could probably see a bit of a swirl. And the only occasion when I saw a submarine off Scarborough, it was a very rough day, and there was no shipping about, and he was fully blown on the surface, probably recharging his batteries, and I spotted him about half a mile away and made for him immediately, but unfortunately he saw me before I got there and made a crash dive. And the sea was so rough and full of white foam that he didn't leave any real mark. But I judged where he probably was, and I dropped a 65-pound bomb, which was all we carried, and nothing happened.
How did you go about releasing the bomb? Was it just thrown over the side?
No, they were slung underneath on a hook mechanism, and the first thing you did was to fuse them, and that was done by pulling a little handle on a wire which took off from the bomb a saddle which prevented the little propeller from going around, and that set the fuse alight. And there was one of these at the nose and one at the tail. But the bomb itself was released by pulling a wire, and the hook opened and down went the bomb.
This bombing incident was the 26th, according to your log, the 26th of the 3rd, 1918, as far as we can make out.
Yes.
On these flights, were you very bothered by the problem of faulty aeroplanes, but, you know, the engine giving way or bearing?
No, it didn't really worry you, but you always had that in mind. And we did have quite a few engine failures. I had one when the engine suddenly stopped with a loud bang, and I was near Bridlington at the time, and I had to make a hurried ascent. I think I released my pigeon when I was down, and eventually a trawler came out from Bridlington and took me in tow, which was rather a long affair, because he couldn't go straight for the harbour, but had to tack according to the wind. At any rate, I was hoisted up onto the quay at in Bridlington Harbour, and I got in touch with my station, and eventually the station Ford van arrived with an engineer, and he took the propeller off, and the front cover of the engine, and it was really rather a sight, because all the connecting rods had broken and were drooping down inside. It was probably due to a piston ring breaking and jamming the engine with a very sudden stop, which would affect all the other connecting rods. At any rate, a new engine was sent off and was fitted to the machine, and I attempted to take off from the harbour, but it was not very successful, because the entrance of it was a bit rough outside, and I didn't like to taxi out and take off in that rough sea. There was quite a longish dog-legged entrance to the harbour, quite narrow, but enough for me, and I tried to open out the engine on the inside of the dog leg and skid round the bend and take off that way. But unfortunately, I didn't get off in time, and a wave hit the propeller and splintered it. So that was that, and I was towed back again. But eventually I returned by land, and the machine was carted away back to Hornsey. But that was only a slight incident.
What other sorts of mechanical or trouble would you have on the design?
Nothing really at all. There was so little to go wrong. The engine was the only thing that could give you any trouble.
Now, but we haven't yet quite discussed the Sopwith Baby. What did you think of the plane? And moving on from that to your favourite one, because they weren't all the same, I think you were telling me earlier. What were the characteristics as a whole of the Sopwith Baby?
The Sopwith Baby was a very fine aircraft. It was really a seaplane version of the Sopwith Pup, which was used in the early days of the war, especially before the Camel came in, as a fighter. It was a lovely machine to fly, very light and manageable, would climb well, and was easy to take off and land on the water. They had their limitations as to height, but I did on one occasion, just for the devil of it, when I was testing the machine, I took it up to just over 11,000, but that was as high as this would go. If you did go up high, you were very unpopular with the senior rigger, because although there was a very small diameter air vent of the floats, it wasn't sufficient to compensate for the air pressure, and it generally ended up with a portion of the float collapsing under air pressure. But that was quite out of the ordinary to fly as high as that.